I'm prim and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
This is like real official looking here. I'm not used to things being that official in AA. We swing by the seat of our pants. I'm a little out of sorts tonight, so y'all will forgive me and bear with me. I spent the evening in the emergency room last night with my son, who is 20, and I'm holding a seat here for him. He took some Xanax and then drank more alcohol than any human being ought to ingest, and fell and broke two teeth and had a bad concussion. So I'll be going back to Al-Anon again. genetically, the poor child just didn't stand a chance, you know. So first and foremost, let me sort of do a disclaimer. My language tends to be very Christian, and I like for each individual person to hear it in whatever language they need to hear it in. So just because I say he or God or Christ or anything like that, please hear it in whatever language you need to hear it in. In AA, it does not matter what you believe in, so long as it's a higher power and it's not you, you know. So I like to say that first off. I thoroughly believe that I was born an alcoholic. I thoroughly believe that genetically I didn't stand a chance, just like my son. Both of my grandfathers died of their alcoholism. Neither of my parents were alcoholics. Neither drank hardly at all, so it was not in the home that I was raised in at all whatsoever. But I was raised in a very abusive household. I was sexually abused by my father and physically abused by my mother. And life was never very pleasant at all. I remember from a very small age saying to myself on a regular basis, something is wrong. Something is wrong. Something is wrong. Something is wrong. And I thoroughly believe that that was not only the abuse that I had survived, but it was my alcoholic thinking from the beginning. The first time I ever drank, I was 13 years old, and my best friend had me over. She'd been my best friend since we were about 4 years old, and no longer lived two doors down from her, but she invited me over. She knew that a bunch of guys were coming, and she knew that I wasn't going to cooperate, and she got me drunk on purpose, and I was gang raped all night long. And it was the beginning of learning how to use alcohol to numb everything. The good, the bad, and the ugly, you know. I ended up hiding in a bathroom that night, pretending to throw up. I was so afraid that I remember putting my hand in the toilet and making the water splash, because I was afraid that they would think I wasn't really throwing up as I was making vomiting noises. Shortly after that, I figured out how to get into my stepmother's liquor cabinet and how to make myself not feel pain, how to make myself smarter, how to make myself prettier, how to make myself fit in, and how to make everybody like me. And I drank on a regular basis from then all out. It was just the way it was. I was young enough that I didn't drink on a daily basis, but I definitely drank Friday night on through to Sunday and lived all week long for Friday night to drink. From the get-go, I drank alcoholically. From the get-go, I blacked out, threw up, made a fool of myself, all of that stuff. I also got into all kinds of drugs. You name it, if I got my hands on it, it was going in my body, smoking it, snorting it, however it went. But my drug of choice was tequila. In the early days, I went to a lot of NA, and that was how I explained myself. I was an addict, and my drug of choice was tequila. When I graduated high school, I went on to college, because that's what you're supposed to do, right? So I went to college where I didn't have any parents looking over my shoulder, telling me what to do and what not to do, and I was very quickly drinking and using on a daily basis. I very quickly figured out how to drink and use and go to class, and I got by the skin of my teeth that I stay in school, and I'm really not quite sure how I did that. Somewhere around my sophomore year in college, what is that, 19 years old, my boyfriend that I had been with for quite some time started trying to slow down my drinking, and he had to go. I had a little bit of a breakdown, and I thought it was my boyfriend that was causing the breakdown. I really think it was that somebody was trying to get through with reality that I was really drinking and using way too much. And I went, in those days, you could go to the local college counseling office and get free therapy, you know. So I showed up and I told them the woes of, you know, my awful boyfriend, and how my life was just, you know, very difficult. And I stayed because I knew that something was wrong. There's that mantra again. Something was wrong, and it was really wrong. So the boyfriend went, but I kept going to this therapy business. Somewhere around that time, my roommate and some friends brought me to UVA to a big party. I was living in Richmond. I was in school at VCU. And they brought me up to UVA to this party, and in a blackout, I fell down three flights of cement steps with metal tips and broke two of my teeth and cracked my jawbone, not unlike my darling son. And I did tell him last night that that was the beginning of the end of my drinking, when I fell down the steps and broke my teeth. I went back to my therapy, and somebody there said, maybe you need to take a look at your drinking. I'm like, I didn't even tell you guys it was drinking. You guys didn't even know I was drinking when I fell down the steps. I don't know where you're getting this from. Y'all are nuts. So I sat down with my best friend, and I said, we have a problem. I think I might be an alcoholic. And my best friend, Ben, said, whoa, whoa, whoa. Alcoholics are in denial. And the fact that you think that you're an alcoholic means you can't be an alcoholic. And I said, whew, man, that was close. That was really close. So I decided that I wasn't going to drink for 30 days just to prove to myself and to the folks in my therapy that I was not an alcoholic. So I didn't drink for 30 days, although I smoked pot on a daily basis. I'm one of those strange people that has some kind of an allergy to mixing alcohol and marijuana. And anytime I had one puff and one sip, I was green and puking toenails. Violently ill with no buzz at all whatsoever. So once I figured that out, somewhere in the middle of all my crazy drinking and using, when I wanted to control my drinking, I would smoke marijuana because it would prevent me from drinking. So, for those 30 days, I would pack the bowl before I went to bed so that I could wake up and smoke the bowl before I even got out of bed and got my day going. So I knew I wasn't going to drink that day. So I got through the 30 days, and we had the biggest party ever to celebrate the fact that I wasn't an alcoholic. And the cycle just seemed to go on and on. I remember waking up every morning saying, I'm not going to do it today. and turning to my roommate and saying, let's not do it today. I remember waking up every morning and turning to my boyfriend and saying, let's not do it today. And sick as a dog, head hurting, puking, ill, you know. I don't know how I did anything. I just don't know how I did anything other than drink and use. I was in the middle of a very big move from one apartment to another. And this old friend of mine was helping me move. We were such old friends that our mothers were pregnant with us together. And our birthday was the same. And he had been wild and woolly back in the day, and I hadn't seen him for years, and I ran into him, and he volunteered to help me move. And in the middle of the move, I was telling him about the escapades of the night before, and, you know, like that little bird in the Little Mermaid where they come to the surface and he's saying, this is this and that is that and this is a dingle hopper. I mean, it was like that kind of a conversation. And we were here and then we did that and then this person did this and then that appeared. And I mean, it was like this crazy, long, drawn out, like, you know, we started with tequila and then there was acid and then it was, I mean, you know, and then the people were ants. And so... somewhere in the middle of all this nonsense, he says to me, oh, I don't do that anymore. And I said, well, you don't do that anymore? How do you not do that anymore? And he said, I don't know how to explain it, but I can take you to a meeting. And I said, okay, I want to go. Show me. And he told me when the meeting was, and he said he would come to get me. And he showed up at my apartment, and I'd had half a bottle of red wine. And I said, I've been drinking. Is it okay to go? And he said, you don't have to go. And I said, no, I really want to go. I just want to make sure I'm not going to offend anybody. And he said, no, come. It's okay. Just come on. And I went to my first meeting, and it was scary and wonderful. And those people were my kind of crazy. They said things that I identified with. They talked about one is too many and 1,000 is never enough. They talked about working the steps. There was this great big scary guy that got up at the end of the meeting and ran around and shook his finger in everybody's face and said, work the steps or die, motherfucker! And I thought, this is my kind of crazy, you know? Like, okay, I am not going to drink or use until I can get back to another meeting. I identified in enough that I knew I wanted a little more of that. And the next day was probably the first day in years that I didn't drink or use for an entire day. And I went to another meeting and another meeting and another meeting. Somewhere around 2 weeks sober, I came home from class, and my roommate had smoked my last cigarette, and I needed to drink. And I needed to drink right now. I was crying, I was screaming, I was pulling at my hair, and it was the end of the world, and I needed a bottle of tequila. And somehow, somewhere, something that somebody had said in a meeting came to me, and she had said that when all else fails, pray. And I didn't know what I believed in. The church that I went to as a small child, the Baptist church, the Baptist camps, all of that fire and brimstone, I had thrown away many, many years ago. I did not believe in any of that at all whatsoever. I was much more I don't know, taken too much acid, eaten too much peyote, crazy kind of, you know. All I managed was putting my hands in my hair, falling on the sofa, and screaming, I can't, and you have to. And I dried my tears, and I took a deep breath, and I went to the 7-Eleven, and I bought a pack of cigarettes, and I went to an AA meeting. Now, in those days, you could smoke in AA meetings. And I chain smoked through the entire meeting, lighting one off of the other, you know. I don't know how anybody gets sober without being able to smoke in AA meetings these days. I don't know. And a lot of people tend to look down their nose at the newcomers that have to, like, go out and have a cigarette in the middle of the meeting. Smoke them if you got them. It's much better than drinking, you know. I came to a point later where my sponsor would not allow me to quit smoking until I was sober for 3 years, because every time I tried to quit smoking, I would want to drink. I would have, like, a nervous breakdown, and I would want to drink. And she said, enough. We're not messing with this anymore, you know. Anyway, this business of praying to whatever it was so much of a spiritual awakening to me, that gripping desire to drink and use was lifted from me. It was unbelievable to me. It was overwhelming that there would be some kind of a higher power that could just remove that desire to drink. There was a wonderful meeting that I went to on a regular basis. It was at this big war memorial in Richmond, and it was massive. And it broke off into this small little splintered meeting where they just read from the 12 and 12 and just read the first three steps. Each meeting they would read the first step, and then the next one they'd read the second step, and then the third they'd go back to the first again. Somewhere in all of that, maybe a month or two sober, it really occurred to me that it's not my fault that I'm an alcoholic. I did not make this choice. I did not wake up one morning and decide, this is who I want to be. I want to be a drunk. I want to be a drug addict. I want to be a thief. I want to be a slut. I want to disappoint every person that loves me. And I want to make a big mess out of my life and everybody's life that touches mine. That was not my choice. It was against my will to be an alcoholic. It was against my will to be a drug addict. And yet, here I was. Now, the beauty of that was that it wasn't my fault. I really thoroughly believed it when they told me that I was not a bad person, that I was a sick person. Thoroughly, thoroughly believed it. I was sick. And like a diabetic that needs to take their insulin, I needed to go to AA to get my medicine. And I was so relieved that I was not a bad person, because that guilt and that remorse and that shame that dogged my every waking moment had been lifted, at least momentarily. And again, it was this massive spiritual awakening. Massive. Now, here's the bad part that went with that. I thought that I'd had my spiritual awakening, and it was really sad that the rest of you poor people had to work a step, but I was good, thank you. And unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. You know, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps is set in step 12. And while I am one of those people who was blessed with a lot of small spiritual awakenings along the way, we do have to work all of the steps if we really want freedom from the bondage of alcoholism. And I didn't believe that, because I was terrified of working the rest of the steps. And I commenced to really tear my life up stone cold sober. Stark raving dry, that's probably a better way to put it. I went through two really messed up relationships. I was 20 years old, and I got involved with a guy that was 40 in the rooms and commenced to just tear it up, start raving dry. And then I got into another relationship with a guy that had formerly been my drug dealer. And he got out of treatment and tracked me down because he heard I was sober. And, talk about a mess. I ended up marrying him later, and my son that I spent the evening with in the emergency room last night is the genetic accident of my alcoholism and having married my drug dealer. So the poor child never stood a chance. At about 3 years sober, I had made enough of a mess of my life that I was either going to drink or kill myself because I was miserable. All I had were the first three steps, and even the third step was not real cemented in my life. I feel fortunate enough that I had become friends with somebody that really was very Christian, and I grabbed a hold of the grace that you get from being a Christian and mixed it with what I had learned of the first three steps, and somehow that gave me enough peace to be okay. Somehow that gave me enough peace. But I was missing so much. So much. I was missing, like, you know, big pieces of getting rid of the shame and the guilt. So at 3 years sober, I was told about this woman that went to a meeting out in the south side of Richmond. And I drove out there and went to her home group. And I wanted what these people had. I wanted the peace that they talked about. I wanted the serenity that they talked about, and I wanted a way of life that allowed me to fix the mistakes that I make from being human. And I got this woman to be my sponsor, and she was the sweetest, kindest, most loving, and demanding woman on the face of the planet. And she said to me, if you want what I have, then you will do what I do, and this is where we start. And let me tell you something, the rubber met the road, and we started going. We did a third step together with her and several of her sponsees that became very dear friends of mine. And I understood what it meant to really turn my will and my life, my actions and my thoughts over to God, and to no longer be in control of what was going to happen in my life. I was terrified of doing a fourth step because so much ugly stuff loomed right underneath the surface. So much of my childhood, so much of that nasty incident that had happened with my best friend and my first night drinking. And I knew if that surface was scratched, that Pandora's box would be opened and all hell would break loose. And my sponsor said, we are doing it anyway. She took me to a Joe and Charlie Big Book study. Do you guys know about Joe and Charlie's Big Book study? If you don't, they are amazing. Look them up. It is wonderful. She took me to this Big Book study where we went and spent the weekend in this hotel and went to these lectures, meetings. Was unreal. And the way that they explained it, I got it. I wanted to do the fourth and fifth step. I wanted to get through it. I wanted to be on the other side. My sponsor gave me those worksheets that Joe and Charlie use, which is essentially the way it's laid out in the Big Book, but in a worksheet format. And she said, you will no longer drag your feet. We are doing your fifth step on this date at this time. Be there and have it done. And I waited until the night before. I stayed up all night long and wrote it all down. Did not sleep, just kept drinking coffee. Got it all down there. Showed up and did my fifth step. And that one horrible incident that happened with my best friend at the age of 13, I couldn't write on that piece of paper. I couldn't do it. At the end of doing my fifth step, she said to me, "Did you leave anything out?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And she said, "Come on, tell me." And I told her. And I told her everything. And when I left that room, I was a different person. They talk about it in the big book. I believe it's in that little list of promises, you know. I was able to hold my head up. I was able to look people in the eye. And I was no longer a bad person. I was a human being. And I had made some bad mistakes. But I had directions set out in front of me that would help me to make all those things right. And again, I had another serious spiritual awakening doing that fifth step. Very, very big spiritual awakening. I shortly after that, got pushed right into my ninth step. She did not waste any time. We were getting busy. And I made that list. I got done what needed to be done. She said, "This is how you're going to do it. You're going to start with this one on your list. You're going to make this phone call, and you're going to call me back." I was shaking so bad. I was so nervous. I thought I would die dialing that phone number. Very quickly, the relief of getting it off of my chest, the relief of owning my bad behavior, became almost addictive. And I couldn't wait to get a hold of the next person to make amends. I couldn't wait to try and straighten it out. I couldn't wait to own it. I couldn't wait for it. And it was amazing to let go of all that stuff. I rolled on through and started getting sponsees and started sponsoring people, and I was doing really, really well. Really feeling like I was on the broad highway, hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. You guys know all that stuff out of the big book. I mean, it was good. Life was good. I had by this point married my former drug dealer, who was going to all of these meetings and had a sponsor, but he couldn't work a step if he fell down a whole flight of them. So he was a big mess. But for the most part, I was able to kind of keep my nose clean and, you know, stay in my own lane and keep my side of the street clean. But there was that part of my life that was not quite right. Somewhere in here, I got invited to a cookout by a guy that I worked with. And I showed up at this cookout, and there was somebody there who was best friends with several of the guys that raped me. And the conversation was like, "Oh, you grew up in that neighborhood? Oh, well, I know so-and-so. Oh, well, I know so-and-so. Oh, yeah, those people. I gotta go. Bye. Thanks for having me." And I went into a full year of crying, a full year of showing up in meetings and at my sponsor's demand saying, "I'm prim and I'm an alcoholic," and then just crying. I cried for an entire year. I kept saying to my sponsor, "How do I get to the other side of this? How do I let go of this? How do I walk away from this? How do I stop feeling awful about this?" And she didn't have an answer for me. She just loved me. Nobody had an answer for me. Everybody just loved me. Somehow, somewhere, in some meeting, I managed to put some pieces of things together. And I realized that the guilt that I was feeling over the way I had behaved as a small child towards my best friend that put me in this position was making me feel like it was somehow my fault, like somehow the bad, ugly child that I was deserved what she had done to me. and the only solution that I knew from working the steps was to make amends. And I had been told by my sponsor and by many people that I didn't know any of these people any amends, but somehow I had to. And I sat down and I wrote a letter to my friend, and I only took responsibility for the things that I had done when we were children and before that incident happened. I apologized for who I was. I apologized for what I did. I owned every piece of it, and I did not bring that night up at all. I put it in an envelope, and I addressed it to her, and the only address I had for her, which was the childhood home that she had had, and I wrote underneath it, "Please forward." I did not put my address on it, because I did not want to hear from her. And I dropped it in the mailbox, and I was free. The weight of the world was lifted from me like nothing I can explain to you all. Lifted. Gone. The power of that ninth step to get rid of the guilt that I felt over stupid things that children do was so powerful. Now the playing field was level. Now it really wasn't okay that they did that to me. And now I could really move on with it. Now, in the middle of all this, women started coming out of the woodwork that had been through similar things. Women started asking me to sponsor them that had survived unbelievable things. I have a sponsee, not watching the time, you guys. I have a sponsee who lived in a home where her father pimped her out to people, where her brothers raped her, and she was eventually sold to a man, and she was grateful for it, because it meant she got away from her father and her brothers. She's now been sober 6 years. Anybody who can survive that and manage to stay sober and not drink on a daily basis is an amazing, amazing person. And now she helps other women who have been through all of that. God has put these amazing women in my life that have just been through hell. And I have been able to take this awful thing that crippled me, that my alcoholism used as an excuse to continually drink and use. And it has turned around and helped save the lives of more women than I can count at this point. It has been amazing to me. Not only that, but having walked out the other side of it, it's just a fact of who I am, you know? My eyes are brown, and this is what happened. Very simple. It's nothing that holds me hostage. It's nothing that controls my behavior anymore. None of that. It is unbelievable to me that I went from being that crippled little girl that would say something is wrong all the time to being somebody that's able to help these women survive. Joe and Charlie talk about it all the time in the Big Book that we have a terminal illness. When I think about how my grandfathers suffered with their alcoholism, how they died from this disease, you know? Before AA, how many alcoholics survived? One in a million, maybe, if they had a heart attack first, you know? I mean, it just didn't happen, you know? A friend of mine in my home group in Richmond used to say to me, you know, in medieval times, they would drill holes in alcoholics' heads to let the demons out, you know? And I can imagine being so tortured by my alcoholism that I would let them do that to me. I can believe it, you know? Now, not only am I not a slave to my alcohol addiction? But I have this way of living that gives me freedom and peace, you know. I do go to Al-Anon again at this point in my life. I started going when my marriage broke up with my first husband, when it became very obvious that he had been staying sober on my coattails. And he didn't want any parts of continuing to grow in AA. I am so far from the person I was, you know, at 3 years sober. I wouldn't even recognize that woman, you know. He didn't want to get better. And it was very painful to let that go and to accept all of that. But I raised my boys, telling them every night, as I put them to bed, as I read them a story, as I sang them songs, you're an alcoholic, is what I said to my boys. Genetically, you're an alcoholic. You do not stand a chance. And you don't ever have to put alcohol in your body. Alcohol is not something that is needed to survive. It has no nutritional value. None. I know people that have never put a sip of alcohol in their body. I had this fabulous neighbor. He was a doctor, and he came from a long line of alcoholics, and he was very well adjusted, which I don't understand, but, you know, he was. And he said to me, I don't drink because I'm afraid of being an alcoholic. I've never had a drink in my life. And so I told my boys about him. I told my boys, you don't ever have to put a sip of alcohol in your body. You don't. And if you don't ever put the first sip in, who knows if you're genetically an alcoholic or not? It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. My two oldest boys, my oldest son who's 24, technically he's my stepson, but he might as well be mine. And his mother is one of us as well, and a very good friend of mine. He will be here eventually. My son who's 20, you guys know he'll be here, you know, with his little broken teeth and his torn up chin and his concussion. He'll be here eventually if he survives that long. My 10-year-old is showing signs of being an alcoholic already. And I just, you know, tell him we have a solution, and if you don't ever drink, you don't ever have to be an alcoholic. And he promises me that he won't drink, but that's what the big one said too, you know. So my boys have been raised in AA. My son that's 20 now, he was the kid that at 10 years old I took him to church, and when we said the Lord's Prayer, he said, keep coming back. It works if you work it. In the middle of church. Yeah. I've been through a lot in sobriety. Not just the stories that I've told you guys, but, you know, going through a divorce was hard. My current husband is also an alcoholic. And you know, it's challenging. Life is hard. There's no promise that just because we put the plug in the jug that life is going to be a bed of roses, you know. Life is challenging. But there are promises that say that I will know how to have peace regardless of what is happening around me, regardless of whether or not my son is suffering from this disease. I can have peace, you know. There was a big chunk of time where my second husband and I were separated, and I really showed my behind good. And I really got a good look at being able to fix the ugly mistakes that we make in sobriety. And I would call my sponsor, and I would say, oh, this is what I did. And she would say, well, you got to call him, and you got to fix it. And I didn't want to, and I did. And I had some peace. And I've learned how to have some dignity, even when I don't feel good. I can have some dignity, which is a truly amazing thing to me, who's good at showing her behind. I I have a lovely little sponsee right now that was supposed to come with me tonight, and she ended up having her kids tonight, so she couldn't come. And I think about her quite frequently when I struggle. She is sober just over a year now, and just before she got a year of sobriety, her father, who'd been sober for 30 years, died in a freak boogie boarding accident. And in the face of that, she decided she wanted to stay sober and got a sponsor and started working the steps. And she goes to about 5 meetings a day and is more willing than anybody I have ever seen in my life. So willing. She does whatever I tell her to do, no matter how horrible her life is going. And she survived some pretty wicked things. We did her 5th step the other night, and to watch the light come on in her eyes was such a blessing in my life to be able to pass that along to somebody else. And it's so funny because when my sponsees are suffering and they call me, and I get out my big book and I go, oh, wait a minute, here, this is what we do, this is how we're going to deal with it. Somewhere in the back of my head, a little voice is saying, what if it doesn't work? What if it doesn't work? What if you can't fix it for? What if you can't make it right? And there's that little bit of panic, you know, that's not going to work. And she always calls me back and says, it worked. It worked. I feel better. It worked. I'm on my way to a meeting. It worked. And what a miracle to be able to see that happen. And it's so funny that even though I know it worked for me, I have that panic. Is it going to work? Is it going to work? And it always does. I thoroughly believe that Bill and Bob were divinely inspired when they put this together. I thoroughly believe that when Bill Wilson prayed and sat down to write those 12 steps, that God stepped in and guided his hand and told him what to put down there. It just doesn't make any sense any other way, because all those other self-help books that I read never worked like this. They just never did, you know. Let's see. When am I supposed to stop?
5:00.
Okay. All right. I'm going to read a portion of my favorite part of the big book to you guys. It's in the family afterword on page 124, although this is an older edition, so it might be on a different page in your big book. It says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. The key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. I don't have much else to say, but being sober has been an amazing experience to me. Being a sober person has allowed me to have peace in the face of the worst things that have ever happened. I'm now best friends with my mother that I hated for many, many years. And even though my father doesn't like me, I say hi and I'm kind to him. And I have no ill feelings in my heart towards him. My sister is now in a situation where she needs to get sober. And I'm trying to help her, although she doesn't want it, just like my son. But I'm available. I'm here. When you decide you've had enough, I'm here, just like my son. Now, I am incredibly grateful to be an alcoholic. If I had not been in a do-or-die situation, and my choices were to die or to work the steps, I would not know the peace that I have in my life today. I would not know the unbelievable joy of watching somebody else have the light come on in their eyes and seeing them not just survive, but thrive. And I am incredibly grateful that I was given the gift of being an alcoholic and the gift of being willing to do whatever it would take to stay sober. Thank you.